Hello, everyone. Welcome to our panel show on the future of energy, lessons from the war in Ukraine. This is being sponsored by the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition and Umpqua Watersheds. Douglas County Global Warming Coalition started in 2003. They're a catalyst for promoting a healthy climate for our community and future generations, identifying and sharing solutions through awareness, advocacy, and collaboration. So they've been out there since 2003, working hard to provide education regarding climate change. And I think all of us on the panel tonight or listening here have engaged with them. They've done remarkable work. Just have a big shout out to Stuart Leibowitz, who started the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition. We also have Angela Jensen, who's Umpqua Watersheds Conservation Director and Legal Director. And I'm Casey Hobick, the moderator for our show tonight. Umpqua Watersheds has been around since 1995. And we have worked closely with most of you. I can see who are in the chat. And we do restoration, education, outreach, and conservation. And really enjoy the opportunity to engage our community. So let's get started with our show. Umpqua, we have many Umpqua community connections to Ukraine through the Umpqua Community College Open World Program. For 5 years, we had people come from Ukraine to be in our community, to learn through Umpqua Community College and multiple organizations in the Umpqua. And we've had this connection for quite a while. We've had people visit Ukraine. Our friends Ken and Jenny Carloni. Ken was a professor at UCC for 33 years, I believe. He and Jenny hosted several families, and they went to Ukraine and met with families. So they know people who are right in the midst of the war. We're Facebook friends. We have a colleague at UCC, Mick Davis, and his wife, Liz, are bringing a family of Ukrainians to the Umpqua. And there are several of us that are helping support that family. And we're open to bringing other families in helping it, helping people who are refugees. And so we're getting constant updates as to what's going on in Ukraine. And the thing about it is, the Ukrainian war, and that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. The future of energy is going to be dramatically impacted by what's happening in Ukraine. So this is very close to our hearts. Ken wrote a wonderful song. You probably didn't get to hear. I'll share it in the notes so you can go and listen to it on SoundCloud. We also have a video at the end that we'll play that is called Ukrainians Now. It's quite inspirational. But the focus of our show tonight is talking about the future of energy and the impact and lessons learned from the war in Ukraine. So Svetlana Kroska talks about the war in Ukraine and the climate crisis are directly connected. Stuart, do you want to say a little about that?
Yes, I think nothing exemplifies more than the connection between the climate and this war, than this very powerful statement by Svetlana. She is a Ukrainian climate scientist and a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Here's what she says. I started to think about the parallels between climate change and the war, and it's clear the roots to both these threats are found in fossil fuels, burning oil, coal and gas is causing warming. And Russia uses these resources and uses this money to buy weapons. This is a fossil fuel war. It's clear we cannot continue to live this way. It will destroy civilization. And the lesson that I draw from this powerful statement is that climate policy is foreign policy because climate change has not taken a timeout for the war.
Yeah, thank you, Stuart. So what is the climate change context we need to look at when discussing the Ukraine war, Stuart?
Yeah, the context, there are several things. Basically, what we're looking at is drawing lessons from Ukraine in several ways. And a couple of things come to mind. This tragedy of Ukrainian refugees that have poured out in the millions, this is a harbinger, in a way, of what we can expect on climate change proper, because we are now seeing climate change refugees. And when we look at the devastating effect that the war has had on the refugee situation, this is a portent of things to come in the climate. In addition, the world in general and the impoverished countries in particular are suffering from food shortages. Of course, Ukraine has been a breadbasket, and the ability to get the food out to these countries has been severely compromised. And climate is also will have a tremendous impact on food shortages down the road as well as now. So these are lessons we can draw from Ukraine as both a symbol of what climate has to offer, but also the symbol of the tragedy of a fossil fuel war.
Well, exactly. A fossil fuel war, which is the impetus for climate change, unless we do something around it. And right now, because we know there are many challenges, and we're going to be talking about that tonight, this horrible thing that we're seeing with refugees in Ukraine and that we saw in Afghanistan and that we're seeing in South America and Mexico, it will be far overshadowed when all the coastlines of the low-lying countries are flooded because of rising sea levels and the impact of millions upon millions of people to other areas of the world. It just, when you look at what's happening in Ukraine and know also that will be an impetus for war as you have more conflicts over space. So that's why it's so important that we address climate change and do everything we can to prevent this cataclysmic occurrence down the road. So, Angela, how dependent are Europe and the United States on Russian oil?
Yeah, thanks, Casey. That's actually a really good question. And just to chime in to what you and Stuart were previously talking about, you talk about refugees in the face of the war in Ukraine, but when we're talking about what climate change is going to bring, it's going to be, yes, it's going to be more of that, but it's also going to be more on the financial crisis and destabilization of governments. And so, you know, that in itself brings about a whole a new can of worms, so to speak, that we're simply not really prepared for unless we address the climate crisis head on. So I just wanted to throw that out there because when we talk about how dependent the US and Europe is on Russian oil, it kind of comes down to economics. And it always does. This is the global world, you know, the economic realm that we live in is driven by global markets. And the oil, petroleum is huge, obviously. We all know this. The US is not as dependent on Russian oil as Europe, but we are. Dependent to a certain degree. We use somewhere between 19 to 21 million barrels per day. Only 500,000 of those come from Russia. So that's less than 2.5% of what we consume comes from Russia. It doesn't sound like a whole lot. On the other hand, Europe relies on Russian oil supply to the tune of like 25% of their consumption. But I think we also need to recognize that Europe in its entirety, you know, uses about 5 million barrels per day, and that's 25% of that of the U.S. So we need to keep this in perspective when we think about who is more dependent and how dependent. We need to understand context. If Europe only requires one quarter of that of the U.S., perhaps we should be, you know, asking about the steps that Europe has taken to be less reliant on oil in general. And I think that's a very important question to be considered here. When my travels in Europe, I know that their individualized transportation in particular, that's not, that is, you know, people don't drive the way we do here in the US. You know, they have railways, walking, they walk everywhere, use bicycles. So their consumption is far less. But I would also say that the US technically still, you know, is not very reliant on Russian oil, since we do have the ability to produce 500,000 barrels each day to replace it. And that is the truth. We have that capacity, but then again, we are reliant on all of the imports because we are importing in addition to using our own production to satisfy our own needs, because we are such a big consumer. So maybe from that respect, you know, we still are reliant. And I also do know that the Biden administration has reached out to Venezuela as well as Saudi Arabia and asked them to increase their production in the wake of Russian oil. So maybe we are a little more reliant than the numbers would give us.
I think we'll be talking about that in the next slide more. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Sorry to get long-winded there.
No.
So, but just one final point, you know, we need to realize that in order to, globally speaking, in order to replace Russia's contribution to the oil market, globally speaking, it's been speculated that it would take all the global spare production capacity, as well as a return to Iranian oil and a ramp up in U.S. production to satisfy that need. So it is a big deal. Yes.
We'll be talking more about this in depth, but it's strange that they're fighting a war against Russia in Ukraine, and Russia is able to hold this over the region and the world that they supply this oil, when the true answer is, okay, you'll do it in a war footing, you do whatever you have to do to win the war. So in World War II, we rationed, we turned out our lights, we did so much as a country and as a world for the war effort in order to win the war, because we had no options. If you right. lose the war, you lose everything. And that's where we are in climate. You know, we're looking at this terrible thing with this Russian oil. We just need to find a way to replace oil and continue on with the oil, rather than focusing on the true culprit of the climate crisis. One of them is our oil consumption, our addiction to oil. So let's move on to the next slide here. Stuart, what has been the response of the United States and Europe in the ramification for halting Russian oil?
Well, first, let's be clear about Putin's view of climate change. I'd like to quote Paul Bledsoe, the former climate advisor to President Clinton. He said, "Putin has acted with utter contempt for the climate. He is planning new oil and gas development in the Arctic, which will hasten the disappearance of Arctic sea ice. He has done nothing to prevent Siberian tundra melt, which will unleash new gigantic methane releases. But the question is, will we follow suit?" Biden's climate advisor, John Kerry, stated, "No one should make it easy to build a 30 to 40 year fossil fuel infrastructure. Unfortunately, that is precisely what Biden is doing in response to the war." And I'll give some examples. He has issued 4 LNG permits through 2050. The U.S. Export-Import Bank has created a program for large loans for LNG export projects. In addition, there are 14 LNG terminals that have already been permitted. It doesn't stop there. Biden has urged fossil fuel companies to begin drilling on public lands, even though they have thousands of unused permits. Further, he has gone begging, as you indicated, to some of the biggest petro-dictators in the world, Venezuela, Iran, and Saudi Arabia. And ironically, even the president of Gas Vista admitted, right now the US and Europe are swallowing the LNG pill, but it's not going to last forever. Carbon neutrality is not going away, even if currently the priority is national security. Kerry assures us this move is temporary and will last but 7 months, and we can still move forward, but there has been excuses like this for 30 years. There's no assurance that there will not be another war around the corner, or even if this war will continue. And as for Europe, they pledged to reduce their reliance on Russia by the end of the year. But the question is, how? Germany is building LNG terminals, holding coal in reserve. Even the leaders of Germany's Greens stated security of our energy supply stands above everything else. All of Europe is pursuing LNG. Poland is stating that shutting their coal mines was a mistake. I'd like to close with an observation by the UN Secretary General Guterres on the response of Europe and the US. He said, "Do not neglect or kneecap policies to cut fossil fuels. Investing in new fossil fuel infrastructure is moral and economic madness."
Excellent. Thank you, Stuart. So, Angela, why don't we have enough oil produced domestically?
I think this is a question a lot of us have been wrestling with. So I'm just going to step back a little bit and give a little, you know, precursor to answering that question, if that's okay. So domestically, the U.S. produces somewhere between 11 to 12 million barrels per day. But this does not even cover our own consumption needs, barely by half. So clearly, we are still relying on imports. But we also still export. You know, we export actually slightly more than we import. So per production, okay. So with the barrels that we produce per day, we're kind of exporting that as well. So we have to import more, not just to satisfy our own needs, but also to replace that we're exporting. This can only be explained by economics, right? I mean, that's the only thing that we can surmise there. So not only are we not producing enough oil for our own consumption, we are still engaging in this international market as an exporter. So again, the first question that comes to my mind is, how does this economically make sense? I mean, obviously, we are not producing enough to supply our own needs, yet we are selling about 15-ish percent of what we're actually producing here. So the answer has to be that we are able to replace that oil that is produced somewhere else cheaper, right? I mean, this is just basic economics. And as we still have to satisfy our daily consumption to the tune of like 10 billion barrels each day, in addition to what we produce domestically, how do we do this? Why aren't we keeping up with our own domestic oil? And that is the question. And according to Forbes, during the pandemic, there was less demand. So supply via production also dropped, and actually dropped to just under 10 billion barrels a day that was being produced. And that was super low. So obviously, demand has since recovered, but production hasn't. And during the downtime of COVID, some oil companies actually went out of business, and some of the previous reliable stripper wells were permanently capped. So the industry basically hasn't been able to bounce back, in other words. So that's part of the reason why we aren't producing enough. And allegedly, U.S. oil companies, and actually, Stuart spoke to this, that U.S. oil companies have stockpiled permits and they simply are not using them. But oil companies are basically countering that with this is not enough. Only oil companies are countering that this is not the only issue holding back production, that, a permit is just the beginning of the process. But also they're blaming, hostile policies of the Biden administration, in addition to a shortage of labor and materials. It is also important to note that just because a company has a permit, that does not mean that they can just sit on it inevitably and it's just going to be there for them to act on it. I mean, if they have a permit, it has a deadline, and if they don't use it, it's often lost. But going back to the Biden administration, it's been speculated that the oil companies have definitely stockpiled permits for fear of, you know, drilling and fracking being banned to some degree under the administration. But again, permits do not automatically translate into production because there are always the obstacles of labor and material. But I would be remiss if I didn't also mention investors. The tighter the supply, the higher the price, right? We all know this. This is economics. This is free market. And investors often will demand that producers maintain what's called capital discipline. And this basically prohibits any rapid increase to in production of quantity. So I think to answer this question, it basically comes down to two points. First, we have free market mechanisms that are allowing U.S. companies and investors to realize huge economic gains by restraining production. Secondly, we are simply consuming way too much. You know, if we look at Europe as a model, you have to ask, why can't we adapt and adjust to a lower level of consumption? And we simply are not. I said two points, but I'm going to bring in a third. Increased production doesn't just happen overnight. Like I said, once they have the permits, that doesn't mean that that automatically translates into production of fossil fuels by any means. So it takes time for that to bounce back. So that's kind of just a general picture of why we're not producing what we need domestically. I think we're addicted to it and we can't get off of it. And that's basically where it is, and money.
What's interesting to me, and this is for both comments by Stuart or Angela, is that we know that the energy industry are hedging their bets to some degree in production because they're nervous about what happened over the pandemic when energy demand dropped so much because people weren't flying and people weren't driving as much and people are Zooming more. And so they saw consumption go down drastically. Isn't that correct, Stuart, that they are kind of hedging their bets and saying, well, we're not going to produce more because the demand may disappear?
That's absolutely correct. They have learned from the pandemic that they cannot necessarily count on the same level of oil consumption. And some investors actually see the writing on the wall in terms of us moving away from a carbon economy. So both of those factors are leading investors to really hold back on oil drilling and also oil production. So those are some of the key factors that oil production has not increased significantly in response to the war.
Hopefully there'll be a massive shift because of that. Again, see both in Ukraine, what it's doing to European economies, knowing that they are being held hostage by the Russians, and we are being held hostage by the oil suppliers, knowing that despite this crisis that we have right now, we aren't going to increase production. We're going to kick the can down the road. Stuart, aren't we already in a climate crisis war and the timeline is accelerating?
That is absolutely correct. You know, we have less time to address the climate crisis, and every excuse that is used to delay action on the climate, in particular on the war in Ukraine, is another month, another year that we cannot afford to wait. The latest UN report was very clear that we need to dramatically reduce our fossil fuel consumption by 2030 if we even have a chance to meet the Paris Climate Accord goal.
So, Angela, what impact will the Ukraine war have on the Paris Accord target?
That is kind of a difficult question to answer. I can speculate a bit. So I do know that the European Union is planning reduction in fossil fuel reliance. I know they've already been headed in that direction. They have relatively high targets of nationally determined contributions in their targets under Paris. You know, the U.S., Russia, and Saudi Arabia are the leading producers of oil, and the U.S. is one of the greatest consumers. So I would speculate that the U.S. would use this, the conflict in Ukraine, as a reason for not reaching its current NDCs under the Paris Agreement. We have used energy insecurity as a reason for not detaching ourselves from oil and fossil fuels before. But the conflict in Ukraine has also had repercussions on Europe's economy in the form of a rise in energy and food prices. And this, of course, could also be a reason for not meeting NDCs under the Paris Agreement. I think what is just as alarming is that the war and the need for Russia's resources has kind of displaced combating the climate crisis from the political agenda in the U.S., perhaps in other nations as well. I'm honestly not sure about that, but I do know here in the U.S. And this is basically because there is now a disruption. Because of this conflict, there is a disruption in the global oil supply chain. And sovereign nations have immediate concerns, you know, about supplying needs to their population however they can. So achieving their NDCs may not be at the top of their priority list. On the other hand, the crisis in Ukraine and the global reliance on Russian oil is also driving, I believe, an understanding that nations must reach for green alternatives. Green alternatives can be translated, should translate into national energy independence. And this obviously coincides with NDC pledges under Paris. For example, and I really am inspired by this, prior to Russia invading Ukraine, Ukraine actually took a very bold step to increase its nationally determined contribution, or their pledge under Paris, from reducing its greenhouse gas emissions from 40% to 65% from 1990 levels by the year 2030. So, you know, that is a huge step. That's 25% more. And they boldly took that step. And this was around August of last year that they did this. And where other nations, particularly the US, were somewhat reluctant to even take steps under Paris for economic reasons, Ukraine is truly setting a standard here. And to put this in perspective, I believe the US committed only somewhere between 26-28% to reduce their emissions by 26-28% below 2005 levels by 2025. So when you look at it on that scale, Ukraine has really taken this bold initiative and something that everybody can look up to and reach for. So, but I want to bring this into the context of the crisis here, right? The Russia invading them. We have already seen the strength of Ukraine during this crisis that Russia has placed on them. But I think we're about to see more of their strength and true inspiration. I mean, if they can reach this target that they've set, even in the midst of this war, this is truly inspirational and must be to the rest of the parties to Paris. Achieving these targets is not just possible, it's achievable, and there is simply not an excuse for any other nation who has signed on to Paris to meet their own targets and even lift them to new heights. You know, we can do this. It's called unity, it's called connection, mutual understanding and strength. And, you know, we're coming together for Ukraine, and I think Ukraine is about to show us all how to come together for climate.
I like that idea, and I think that's something that we should all focus on. All the countries in the world should focus on Ukraine and make sure they hit those targets. What will it take? Because it's important for Ukraine to get off Russian oil, to build a new society afterwards, and that's what we're going to talk about.
Let's take a break. We'll be right back after these announcements.
Hi, this is Casey Hovick, Executive Director with Umpqua Watersheds.
And I am Ryan Kincaid, Umpqua Watersheds Director of Education and Outreach, as well as the Chair of the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee.
Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives different people have to offer and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute.
We are excited to utilize our radio station, KQUA, as a platform for marginalized voices. If you are interested in hosting a radio program honoring diverse perspectives and elevating those who have been oppressed, please email your idea to ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. That's ryan@umpquawatersheds.org.
Programming on KQUA 99.7 is funded in part by Umpqua Valley Audubon Society, connecting people with nature to inspire the protection of our natural world. More information at www.umpquaaudubon.org.
Programming on KQUA is supported in part by Medicine Flower, specializing in flavors, aromatherapy supplies, natural remedies, and rocks and minerals from around the world. More information at genuineessentialoils.com.
Rebuilding Ukraine using green infrastructure and technology, it could be the manufacturing engine for the European Union. As a Green New Deal. So you've got a situation where a country that has been devastated and bombed and cities destroyed, the world can come together and say, hey, let's make them the model. Let's make them the way we should all be. And then, as you said, use Ukraine. If Ukraine can do it, we can do it. This is a war. This is a climate war that we're in. We were seeing a physical battle, a war in Ukraine because of the Russians' invasion. But the climate war will impact every country, is impacting every country, and we have to win the war, and we need to rally around something. I think that's part of the problem, is that we're kicking the can down because we haven't had anything to rally around. We feel good when we are working on these agreements and come to, okay, we need to get to this level by this date. And everyone celebrates, and then it comes up towards that date, and we say, well, we've had a pandemic, or we've got this horrible war in Ukraine. We can't meet those targets. No, that's the exact opposite way that we should be approaching it. We should look at the war in Ukraine and look at the war for climate change and say, we need to win this war. Don't you think, Stuart?
Yes, and I think the way to approach it, and I'm hopeful that in the end that Ukraine will prevail. When Ukraine prevails, they will need a world Marshall Plan to rebuild that country. And the world needs to bring together the resources just they have had to do so to defend their country. When they bring that Marshall Plan for Ukraine together, they can create a green country, and that country can serve as a model for the future. We can make this an opportunity to build on the ashes and the ruins of this devastating and barbaric war. And on top of that, once we look at that model, we can then say, if the world has been able to get together to defend Ukraine, they can also get together to have a world Marshall Plan to gather all resources and utilize the Ukraine model that we would envision for everybody. So we can tie the climate with this war and build on the tragedy and make it a triumph more ways than one.
So just to have a little history refresher, I imagine most people are familiar with the Marshall Plan, but George Marshall was the Secretary of State of the United States after World War II. And we just won this war. We came up with remarkable technologies during the war to win the war. Unfortunately, the atom bomb was one of them, and atomic energy then after that we've utilized. but we did come together and we recognized part of the reason we recognized it was an abysmal failure after World War I to rebuild economies and rebuild countries, even defeated countries. Everyone just said they wanted to go after those countries like Germany and make them pay for the war, which ultimately created a very nationalist fervor in Germany and an independence, and the whole war, and less than 15 years later, started up again. But the Marshall Plan, the brilliance behind what the U.S.-led Marshall Plan did was not only in Germany and Great Britain and France and Japan. They took all the technology that we had developed in the war, in the infrastructure that we did, what was far ahead of what Europe had at the time before the war, and were able to rebuild those countries. So they came out of the war much stronger than they were before in a lot of ways, and democracy flourished as a result. And that's what we need to do with the green technology. We need to use that we're going to rebuild societies, because we have to rebuild all our societies in order to win the climate war. We have to get green. We have to get off oil, because oil, we can see it. Who owns the oil? The oligarchs, you know, people that are controlling our country and have an impact on our daily lives, because they can control the consumptions. The Saudi Arabia, the people there, the Russians, they know we have an addiction, and they take advantage of that addiction by doing terrible things to other people and other countries. Going green is the greatest, to me, it's one of the greatest democratization tools that could ever be, because you're taking, instead of a precious resource, supposed, like oil that's in the ground in these countries, and going for solar or going for wind or going for other green technologies that isn't isolated to one particular area that happens to have these oil reserves. What do you think, Angela?
I completely agree. You know, I think this is exactly, you know, it's always been the right time to wean ourselves off of our fossil fuel addiction. But I think right now, with what we're facing, this in the Ukrainian crisis, as we're facing at the same time the climate crisis, we don't have a choice. You know, we have to move forward. We have to. And this is, to me, this, you know, we should all be inspired to use this as the reason to move forward. You know, and I just want to bring up, you know, the fossil fuel industry, they're saying something completely different. They're using the Ukrainian crisis to bolster their position that, you know, regulations regarding drilling and fracking need to be far less restrictive, because, you know, we need them and we are reliant on them. But, you know, it's time to wean ourselves off of it. And in a nutshell, you know, the fossil fuel industry is trying to capitalize on this, but we're going to step back and say, hey, no, we can do this different, because Ukraine's doing it different. They've pledged to do it different. Europe has already been trying to do it different, even before us. You know, we need to step up our game. And I think we need to step that up under Paris and the Conference of Parties to follow, the COPs. And we can do it. This is the time. I think this is truly a time to not step back and say, you know, we've got to take care of the war first. This is exactly the time to say, we can do this at the same time, and that should be our policy. That's our strength.
Absolutely. Stuart, any comments regarding this question and rebuilding the Ukraine under a Marshall Plan? We started out with you, but I want to give you a final comment there.
Yeah, I just have a couple of comments. First of all, it's a very simple axiom. Force more to ruin the earth, save it. So it makes economic and moral sense to have this Marshall Plan. There are things we can do now, and there are things we can do in the future, and we hope that the future with Ukraine will be coming soon. You know, when we talk about drilling, we can demand that the fossil fuel companies, if they drill at all, They must align their goals with the Paris Climate Accords. We can demand that. Absolutely refuse to allow any infrastructure for more than a year or two, rather than extending it out for 30 years. There are things we can do now in preparation for this Marshall Plan. Transition begins now, and let the lessons of Ukraine be our inspiration to begin that journey. And when Ukraine wins the war, we'll be right there because we've already moved forward and laid the groundwork for this to happen.
I agree that statement that it costs more to destroy the world than it does to save the world. It rings true every time I go out and hug a big tree, and because I'm thinking, oh, they're always saying they're going to come up with this magical remedy of coming up with some machine that is going to reverse carbon or whatever. And we got a tree and that has been there for 300 or 400 years, and it's doing remarkable things, that one tree for the ecosystem, but taking carbon out of the air. And you look at that tree and think, okay, if they're going to create a machine that's going to do what this one tree is, how much would that machine cost? And could they ever create a machine? We've shown in the past, in a very short amount of time, that we can sacrifice and we can focus in order to protect our economy and the safety of our population. We have to fix this now. I really believe that by focusing on Ukraine, by taking them as an example in the heroic work that they're doing there in the face of unbelievable odds, that they are taking a stand against this major superpower and in a lot of ways winning that. So we're running a little earlier than we anticipated. This is something I appreciate Angela and Stuart and working through this together. We are in the process of doing these monthly climate events where we bring people together to have a discussion on something. And this month, we really wanted to focus on Ukraine because it is so timely and we do have such a connection.
Can I just chime in to, Stuart's quote there about it costs more to destroy than it does to preserve. What was that quote exactly? I would like to hear that again.
It costs more to ruin the earth than to
That's
save
right.
it.
That's right. And, a lot of times, the work we do as Umpqua Watersheds and our conservation committee, we're trying to conserve, we're trying to preserve, because we do know that if there was a proper cost placed on the destruction of our trees and on our environment and on our watersheds, it does cost more to destroy than it does to preserve and protect. And I've always said, if you could make preservation profitable, then the economy would not get in the way of what we need to protect. Our economy, unfortunately, isn't driven that way. But if we actually associated and put a price tag on the true cost of our exploitations of oil, of forests, we would see the true costs, and then perhaps preservation would be profitable.
And it's all a matter of perspective. And most of us on this call can look back 50 years and look at where things were in 50 years ago. Of course, in 1970, a lot of good things happened because a lot of bad things had happened in a very short period of time after the war. And we improved so much of our environmental laws that helped reverse some horrible things that were happening, and they're still happening. But you look at the economy and things that we have now that we didn't have then, that we're spending trillions upon trillions of dollars. I love baseball, but back in the 60s, a professional baseball player had to have two jobs. They'd play baseball for 6 months, and most of them had a second job, even though they made good money playing ball. But most of them, like Hank Aaron, he worked for the Coca-Cola company.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and now we have entertainment, and I don't mean to blast entertainment, but we're spending trillions of dollars on entertainment that we never spent before, and saying at the same time now, oh, we can't get off oil, we can't go green in a short period of time, we can't transform our economy that fast, when we know we can, because when we do, it will open up so much more opportunities for us down the road when we don't have to worry about destroying our planet to bring out supposed precious resources that we can't live without. To me, I'm very inspired by a new connection that Uncle Watershed has with GreenTeacher.com. They're a Canadian nonprofit. They're in 75 different countries working with the projects. And Uncle Watersheds is now a partner with them. So we'll be putting up their podcast. But one of the things that we were talking about the other day with Ian was that there's a thing that they have that used to have what they call steampunk. I don't know if folks are familiar with that term. You can Google it. But it is this thing that came out in the 1800s and then was a vision of the future that would all involve steam and sort of kind of nouveau thing. Now that they have all these cartoons of all these steampunk contraptions that, you know, now it's are electric or gas or whatever. But there's a new thing called solar punk, and it's envisioning a future that is totally green and what it could do to the planet and do to relationships and take the stress out of this extraction mentality. When we know that 99% of the energy coming to the earth from the sun is not being used. So we know the energy is there. We know there's an opportunity to get off this and build a better life. We just have to get people to visualize that. And I believe our young people are starting to do that, is visualize green. And that's what we talked about Ukraine. How can we turn this around? Use Ukrainians and the heroism that we're seeing on a day-to-day basis and the connection that we have with them personally to inspire us to go out and do the hard thing, inspire us to go out and build a better world. We can do that. That's what we've done many times before, and we're being told by the people that are controlling the oil and the power that goes along with it that we can't do it.
Absolutely.
The inspiration is twofold. Obviously, the courage and tenacity and ability to put up with such barbarity and pain is an inspiration to us that we too can measure up when we put our mind to it. And the other thing to remember is if the world can come together to defend Ukraine, which we absolutely have to do, they can also come together, build a new Ukraine, also a new world that embraces a clean energy future.
Absolutely. It's all about telling a story, and I really believe we can tell that story here in the Umpqua by continuing to work together and doing what the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition has done for so long at events and working together to inform the community is so inspirational. And that's what I love about what Uncle Watersheds has been doing in working with you. And I'm proud that we're part of the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance, 70 different groups out there that are working together to impact policy. Janice, you have any thoughts?
Just the issue that Ryan had brought up in her book club to just raising smaller families. And I think the climate crisis is also that we haven't addressed the continual population growth around the world, and that the earth cannot sustain such an accelerated growth rate. You know, working toward mitigating climate change and changing the way that we live, we also need to think about having fewer kids.
I agree completely.
Yeah, I agree. I agree completely. In fact, when I was in undergrad, my philosophy instructor, I told him that I never intended on having kids because I didn't believe that our planet in our climate could sustain that. And he said, well, I don't believe that's a very good reason for not having a family. And I thought to myself, what kind of family would I be supporting in a world where I understood that overpopulation was going to impact their future? And I think that it, you know, that is a profoundly deep question. We need to understand that. And it is a tough question because there are people out there who, you know, they live for their children and then the grandchildren that can come. But I implore people to really think about what that future is going to look like when so many people, particularly a population in the United States, thinks that we can just move forward with the status quo, that we're always going to have this energy, that we're always going to have this addiction to oil, that everything that we want is always going to be there. It's not going to happen. It's not sustainable. We've already seen that. The climate is already insanely stressed as a result, and we've got to turn this ship around or else the repercussions are going to be felt by the children and the grandchildren. And us as adults now need to take that responsibility and think about the welfare of what that future generation would look like if we don't rein in an increase in population.
So there's a comment in the chat.
Viviana is Umpqua Watershed's AmeriCorps, a superhero. Go ahead and read it.
The reason a lot of people want us to have more kids is because we need more workers, when in fact, we have such an incredible amount of waste food, empty housing, et cetera, that we in fact need less workers as it stands, and to focus more on using what we're already producing to help the people that are already struggling on this earth.
I think this conversation is extremely connected to reproductive rights also, and the access to birth control. This is Connie. And I mean, I think it's interesting it's going this direction because I always think that's a really important comment that nobody wants to look at. Nobody wants to look at that overpopulation is driving climate change in a lot of ways. I mean, it's a bad decision also, but you know, people could have a child or two, you know, still have a family if that's important, but we still need the basic right to control. Women need the basic right to control their bodies and have access to birth control and the science of birth control and improved ways to have birth control so you can make those decisions for yourself. I just think that's a really important part of this whole conversation. So thanks, Janice, for bringing it up.
It's all connected, everything that is going on in our society and the world and the politics. We need to re-envision the way we live. It's not sustainable to have multiple homes, cars, and so much stuff in general. Switching to alternative renewable energy is so important for all of our well-being. If as a country we want freedom and independence, we need to decrease our reliance on fossil fuels and from other countries, especially those led by authoritarian regimes.
Well, I think one of the important parts of the whole the climate crisis and the current political crisis regarding a woman's right to choose is that we need more women in government. We don't have the best of our best out there. If you look at the pandemic and what we've done in 2 years, how we've been able to transform in a lot of ways. And we did cut down on oil consumption because we weren't flying and weren't taking cruises. We've shown what we can do in a short period of time if we have to do it. And somehow we have to get to the point where we know we have to do it. That's what's happening in Ukraine. They know they have no other choice. Either stand up or die or lose your country. And that's exactly what we're facing in the very near future. Angela and I met at the Vermont Law School. We both enrolled in a program, a master's program, environmental law and policy. And we both had an emphasis in climate. The thing that hits me over and over again, this was 8 years ago, I guess, when we were there, the projections that we were looking at and what I remember them saying is that, well, we're not going to see any major, you know, it's not going to be drastic. These storms and these cataclysmic events may not happen for, you know, further on down the road, but it seems to me that it's happening a lot faster than I ever imagined. What do you think, Angela? Is it different than what we'd learned in class as far as the projections?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember when we were studying the climate models and the reports coming from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that those speculations were spaced out there and they were very subtle. And if you remember, Casey, the strength of the opinion was the scientists would say whether it was with a certain amount of degree, right, of certainty, degree of certainty. Those were their terms. And it was kind of, you know, it was always mediocre, like they didn't know the degree of certainty, or it was with, you know, somewhat mild certainty. And that escalated within the next 4 years, because the IPCC assessment reports come out every 4 years, I believe. Is that right? I think it's every 4 years. And they rapidly went from, you know, we're somewhat certain to we are very certain. And those timeframes where they were became very certain that these impacts would happen closed, right? So instead of it happening within 20 years, they speculated that it would happen a lot sooner. But I also remember that when I was reading the fourth assessment report, they were saying that we would see decreased snowpack in southwestern Oregon. And I was living in southwestern Oregon, Selma, to be specific, at the time. And I was reading that assessment report, and I was looking up at the mountain where I remember seeing snowpack on that mountain every winter. And for 3 years in a row, since that time, we didn't see the snowpack. We didn't have a snowpack. And so where they were saying, oh, it's coming, I'm sitting there saying, and I wrote this in my journals as well as on some of the essays that you and I engaged in and correspondences, that it was already happening, where the IPCC scientists were saying this is going to be in the future. I was already seeing it. And that's the importance of it. That's the urgency. And I can't stress that word enough. That's why climate, this crisis, is urgent. We have to address it now, because it's hitting us fast, and faster than the scientists speculated. So I'm going to be an alarmist. I was about to say I'm not going to be an alarmist, but I absolutely am, because this is alarming. And that's why we have to act on it immediately, yesterday.
Now, I'd like to offer my own closing thoughts here and tie it back into Ukraine. Sort of a personal thing. My grandmother escaped Ukraine. It was under Russia, of course, at the time, during the Russian Revolution. And she and several members of her family tried to escape, and she left her brother back as a decoy, so the Russians would not know or suspect that they were trying to leave. And during this exodus, they had to cross a swamp. And my cousin Rose, who was blind without glasses, lost her glasses. So they had to sit all night in that cold swamp, watching Russian boots walk back and forth till daylight came, and they could look for my cousin Rose's glasses, which they ultimately did find. It was that courage back then that mirrors the courage of Ukrainian refugees now. And because of their courage, they have a grandchild who is here in the United States, who is dedicated to fighting climate change. When I look at the other Ukrainian refugees, I know that there are those who will also bring that type of hope. And so to me, that's how the connection binds Ukraine and fighting climate. That's my closing thought on it.